Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 243, Ramez Nam Crux Giveaway.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding. Oh,
man.
And now, podstructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by a rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Public.
Hey everybody, thank you so much for listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. I'm your host, Timothy C. Ward. Before we get to Brent Bowen's interview with Ramez Nam, a couple things I want to mention. First, Angry Robot Books, one of my favorite publishers, is offering a paperback giveaway of Crux, Ramez Nam's sequel to Nexus. It's very cool cyberpunk thriller about nanotechnology that creates a kind of telepathy. Very good stuff. And I'm very excited for you guys to win that. So what we're going to do is run a giveaway by commenting on the post for this podcast about why you want to read Ramez's books. And we will run this through Friday, December 20th. I will announce a winner the next day. So you'll have all day on Friday, up to Friday, to enter. While you're heading to our website to comment on this giveaway, I am curious what your thoughts are about the future of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Guess what? My wife is having a baby. The due date is January 8th. This is our first baby, and people keep telling me that I'm not going to have any time for anything, so... yeah, it's making me think about what the priorities are for this show. Since I took over in June, I have done my best to get probably 3 posts a week. We've got on Tuesdays the SF book releases this week. We got book reviews and podcasts. And that's taking up time. Another change in my life is that I no longer get to write during my day job. I know, boo-hoo, just like everybody else. But that's what I've been doing for almost 5 years, and one of the reasons why I podcast is because I get my writing in during the day. I've got some time at night. My brain's already tired. Why not contribute to the community of podcasts and learn from awesome authors? So now that I have to write before work, after work, before bed... what I really want to do is be a full-time writer. I don't necessarily want to podcast, write book reviews, and maintain a website. I'm not giving up. We're not pod-fading or anything, but I just wanted to let you guys know this is my situation. If you would like to help, by all means, send me an email, adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. If you want to review books for us, I suppose we might have some room for that. I'm not really wanting to edit much besides typos, so it's got to be pretty quality stuff. The other thing I'm interested in is, what do you guys like most? What do you want me to make a priority about Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing? Is a podcast every week essential? Every other week? Once a month? And what type of articles... is it worth for us to put out there? Is it worth my time and our contributors' time? So that's our little service announcement. Things are going well. I've been getting about 500 words in the morning and some more at night. So I'm still writing. It's all good. But, you know, sometimes you got to make a list of priorities and accept that you can't do everything you want. Without further ado, enjoy this interview with Brent Bowen and Ramez Nam.
This is Brent Bowen at the 2013 Worldcon in San Antonio. I'm so pleased to welcome our next guest. He's a computer scientist who has led work on Microsoft Outlook, Internet Explorer, and Bing. His work has also focused heavily on neural networks, AI, high-scale information retrieval methods, and advanced software tools for molecular design. He writes both fiction and nonfiction that explores future science and technology and its effect on society and the environment. Late last year, Angry Robot Books published his debut novel, the techno-thriller Nexus, to critical acclaim. The follow-up, Crux, just hit bookshelves, real and digital. Ram Esnam, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brent. Thanks for having me.
Great, Maz. It's so cool to have you. It looks like you've been having a blast at Worldcon this year.
Thanks. Worldcon has been awesome. It's Sunday, and I've just been having an incredible, incredible time. I'm going to be sad to leave.
I am too. Although the Pepto count is up high.
I'll be happy to get more sleep.
Yeah, if you could have supplied Nexus to us, I think over the weekend, I would be a lot better off.
That would have helped us all, actually, yeah.
So let's start with Nexus and Crux. If somebody's been in a bunker and haven't heard about it, there's been a lot of buzz about these books. Tell our listeners about the books thus far.
Yeah, so imagine there's a drug you could take that if you took it and a friend or a family member or a loved one took it, you would get some sort of telepathic connection with them. You'd start to experience what they're experiencing, what they're feeling, what they're thinking, and vice versa. So that's Nexus. It's a drug. It's a silvery liquid you drink from a vial. But really what it is, it's a collection of nanobots that cross through your blood-brain barrier into your brain and wirelessly send out radio waves telling the world around you what your neurons are doing and vice versa. So that's the drug Nexus. And the book Nexus, it's set in 2040. It's a near future techno thriller about this technology, Nexus, which is highly illegal because other technologies like it, other nanotechnologies and biotechnologies have been abused. They've been used in terrorist attacks. They've been used to coerce people to, you know, rob them or coerce them or turn them into slaves and so on. But my protagonists are kind of young and naive and think there's all kinds of cool things we can do with this. We can extend the range. We can build apps that run inside of your mind and so on. So it's a high-octane, super fun techno thriller. Starts off in San Francisco, heads to Bangkok, Thailand, scenes in China and Shanghai. There's explosions, gunfights, Buddhist monks, emergent group mind, enhanced Chinese clone soldiers, cyborgs, super spies, stealth submarines, and some deep philosophizing about the nature of consciousness and ethical responsibilities of scientists.
So how did these books come to be? At one point, I mean, you've got a mashup of all these ideas that you just mentioned, and with your background in science, at what point were you saying, okay, I'm going to mix this in a melting pot and we're going to make this thing go. How did these books come to be?
Well, I've worked at Microsoft for 13 years, but in two different stints, each one about 6-7 years long. And so my second stint, I was in a writing group for fun, writing something, and I thought it was a short story. I didn't know what it was. And then when I decided it was time to leave Microsoft and I quit, I was working on another nonfiction book, actually, and got stalled on that and said, well, you know what, I'm just going to go turn back to this piece of fiction I have and start working on it some more. And before you know it, I had something that looked like a novel. And you know, they say write what you know. I guess I just wrote what I'm passionate about. I'm not a Buddhist, but I'm kind of a lapsed meditator. I used to be a daily meditator, and I'm fascinated by that. I had I have two buddies who are neuroscientists who have been to small conferences with the Dalai Lama, where neuroscientists are talking about brain scanners, and the Dalai Lama and Buddhist monks are talking about how meditation is a way to study the mind as well.
Sure.
And they're trying to learn from each other. And I have a lot of friends who are in Burning Man culture. I'm in Burning Man culture. So I just kind of threw all of these things together and said, what if the breakthrough in neurotechnology, and then you could write code against, was actually illegal, but was also being used by Buddhist monks in Thailand to achieve enlightenment? And yeah, I just kind of barfed up what I thought was cool.
It was cool. Well, and I think I absolutely adored Nexus. I thought it was cool.
Thank you.
The pacing was such as, I mean, you got the techno-thriller component of that as well. One of the other cool things I thought about it, though, is, you know, you've got Caden, who's the protagonist. I guess you could call him the protagonist.
Yeah.
But the interesting part about it is you talk about him being young and naive, And one of the things I really liked about the thread of all through the book is the moral ambiguity.
Yeah.
So how did that find its way into the book? Is it, you obviously made a conscious decision around, let's bring the intersection of these ideas together and not posit them as right or wrong. And he's truly a conflicted character through the entirety of that novel.
I don't really believe that the world is full of that much black and white. I think there's a lot of situations that really are gray. And I think, you know, I'd point to, I think we're going to talk a little bit later about kind of the surveillance situation in the U.S. right now and the NSA and so on. So, you know, I have complaints about that. But I don't think the people at the NSA are, you know, scheming supervillains, wiggling their fingers together and saying, oh, yes, we will spy on Americans. They're doing what they're doing for reasons that they think are fully legitimate. They want to keep us safe and so on. So I wanted to portray that in the book. The book, in a lot of ways, is an allegory for the war on drugs and the war on terror. And it's talking about at what price security. Should we, in the book, the conflict is, should this sort of research be squashed? Because in the past, it really has been used for terrible things. Or should it be embraced in some way, either fully enthusiastically embraced or cautiously embraced, because it also has so much potential for good in the world,
sure,
to bring people together or to cure diseases or make people smarter or whatever. And so I throw characters together that are on very different sides of that, mm-hmm, and put them in situations where they have to talk about it or fight over it or whatever. And I try to show how each of them has come to their beliefs while never letting you put the book down.
And you do an excellent job of that, interspersing, I think, the action with the reflection, or those points of reflection. And that's why I thought it was the first one in particular is a truly enjoyable novel.
Thanks.
So one of the questions that I got, actually, I posed some questions to some folks on Twitter, too, tied to the books. And I thought it was a really interesting, several people actually responded back to me on this. So I thought it would be good to chat about is, because publishing has such a lag time, and for that matter, a lot within scientific discovery does too. In fact, it's probably longer once you get through FDA approvals and everything else.
That's quite long. It's very long.
But a couple people asked, any tech improvements between the publication of the two books that had you maybe thinking about that either created challenges in the plot or actually solved some problems with the plot between Nexus and Crux?
You know, there have been tech improvements in the neuroscience space. So I did one here about the wired brain and the actual science of putting electrodes in people's brains and animal brains and so on. And so I did one when Nexus came out in December of 2012, and I've done it again now, 8 months later. And so I had a section on updates. What it showed, like, three amazing things that have happened just in those 8 months. So the field is moving very, very fast. But of course, it's still not caught up to my 2040 projections. Right?
Sure.
But I would say there's other things. You're a sci-fi writer. I'm writing about things in 2040. I'm writing about a Cold War between the U.S. and China as, mm-hmm, part of the backdrop of this, and spies and conflicts. But I don't think I really included enough about drones, to be totally honest. So even though I wrote Nexus mostly in 2011, I was kind of caught flat-footed by how big drones have become in warfare now. So sometimes these things just kind of catch you by surprise, how quickly sci-fi technology gets distributed through society.
Yeah, true advancements and how those get incorporated into culture. Very interesting. So let's talk about society and the notion of our adaptability. And I heard a presentation just a couple weeks ago. I went to a local TED talk. I'm out of Kansas City, and they actually do a really nice job of producing some TED talks. And there was a neuroscientist there. And his whole talk was based on the premise of, as a species, we're not equipped to deal with kind of the plugged-in, multitasking lives we lead today. And he actually posits that that's one of the major causes for clinical depression in our society. So if you were to sit across from this neuroscientist and have a discussion, because I know you like to speak on the subject of adaptability and our need to evolve with and incorporate technology as part of that equation, what would that discussion look like?
Well, first, I'm an optimist, so when somebody says something pessimistic to me, the first thing I want to do is question that. Like, well, are you sure people really are more depressed now than they were in, you know, hunter-gatherer societies and so on? Psychological diseases or conditions are especially tricky because diagnostic criteria change.
Sure.
Data
changes probably too.
Well, ADHD is, you know, so big now. When I was a kid, I would absolutely have been diagnosed as being ADHD if today's diagnostic criteria existed. Sure. So some of the rise of ADHD is just, we're diagnosed it more often now, right? Mm-hmm. That said, like, I do notice that there are days that I will get a little bit overly attached to my Twitter feed. And those are not my happiest days. So I think you have to have some balance. Like, I think that all of this access to information is incredibly enriching. It's incredibly rewarding. And I'm, you know, much more enriched as a human being because I can know so much more and interact with people. I mean, my experience here at Worldcon has been so much richer because I've spent a lot of the weekend hanging out with Paolo Bacigalupi, who we were just talking about, mm-hmm. who wrote The Wind Up Girl. I know Paolo. I met him last year at Worldcon, drunk at 2 a.m. But really, I've gotten to know him. We had a great conversation then. Really, I've gotten to know him because we chat on Twitter a whole lot.
Sure.
Over the intervening year. And that led to an amazing weekend of just kind of hanging out most of the weekend, right? So that's a like clear enrichment, plus all the things that I've learned. But sometimes you've just got to unplug and say, you know, today I'm going to focus on my family in the real world, or today I'm going to go for a bike ride, or today I'm going to go for a hike, or I'm going to get this next chapter of this book written instead of obsessively rage-tweeting about the latest NSA scandal or catching up on what Miley Cyrus is doing or whatever. So there's a balance, you know, like you can use these technologies to enhance yourself. And actually, another buddy of mine, he reviewed my very first nonfiction book. His name is Alex Pang. He has a book either coming out or has just came out. I blurbed it. It's a nonfiction book, and it's called The Distraction Addiction. Okay. And it's actually a super philosophical book, but it's about how do you use tech, especially like information tech, texting, Twitter, Facebook, and so on, to like make your life richer, but not become a slave to it.
Interesting.
Keep the tech a servant to you, enhancing your life, and don't let yourself become its slave.
And what was the name of the book again?
The Distraction Addiction.
Addiction.
By Alex Soojong Kim Pang. I think just Alex Pang, P-A-N-G.
Okay.
We'll get you there.
Oh, awesome. That sounds like something I would truly enjoy, because that's a conversation I have with my wife all the time is, I'm not using it because I'm a slave. It is actually enriching our life. We will find the restaurant much quicker.
I think I might need to read this book again, actually.
Awesome. One of the things, so let's talk about the adaptability thing, because that's another question I actually received online when I had mentioned I was going to be talking to you, was why do you believe, though, because we do have certain cultures and certain societies that are extremely averse to adapting to technology or embracing it, even though they may be in the most desperate of times. And why, you know, in your course of study and your course of conversation, why do you think that is? They could be extremely desperate and still not want to embrace innovation.
You know, I think it varies by type of technology and type of innovation. People seem very friendly in general in the modern world to embracing new high-tech electronic sorts of innovation. You know, the latest gadget, whether it's an iPad or an iPhone or an Android gizmo or whatever, seems to race through society, and not just Western society, everywhere. Asia, you know, loves them. Sub-Saharan Africa loves them. Like, there's hundreds of millions of cell phone subscriptions there. Now there's a $35 Android tablet, 7-inch tablet, being sold in India. It's amazing. That thing is going to revolutionize education. So that sort of stuff goes well. Biological stuff. This is actually my first nonfiction book. More Than Human was all about biological enhancement, and it had a lot about why do people reject this. Biological enhancement or biological technologies have a long history of being rejected. So it was more than 200 years ago that Jenner created the first smallpox vaccine. Mm-hmm. The way that the smallpox vaccine was created, if you think about it, was kind of gross. So cows get this disease called cowpox, mm-hmm. which is closely related to smallpox. It's a related virus. And Jenner had noticed that milkmaids who worked with cows wouldn't get sick. They would not catch smallpox. Even when smallpox ravaged their villages, the milkmaids who were around cows all the time didn't get smallpox. So he said, them being around the cows is doing it, and cowpox looks so much like smallpox, I wonder if that's it. So he actually scraped like cowpox sores and put them on humans as a way, and people were like, that is nasty, you know? And people, the newspapers had editorials showing like a half-human, half-cow hybrid as what he was going to turn us into, like these minotaur things, but it worked, okay?
Sure.
But it took years, at least, for society to accept that this was a okay thing to do, because it just seems gross.
Yeah, some of the similar to it, that's similar to a lot of the cancer discoveries that have taken place of late, where they've talked about actually using other diseases to offset or actually take on the cancer cells.
Yes. So we have this gross response, basically, and it might even be evolutionarily into us. Think about it, bodily fluids are disease vectors as well. If you encounter blood in the wild, there's a high chance that it's a vector, especially if it's blood of your species. Mm-hmm. That's a way to get a vector of disease. Human waste products are a vector of disease. So it might be that we are evolutionarily, or it might be just cultural as well, that we have good reason to avoid the internals of other people's bodies. And so anything like that kind of triggers this rejection. The same thing, blood transfusions were considered very ethically squeamish. Organ transplants, a little bit, certainly. Stem cell therapy, anything like that. Genetic engineering. IVF. Okay, so now 1% of children born in the U.S. this year will have been conceived via in vitro fertilization. Now, IVF, we just call it IVF now, so we just say, oh, my wife and I, we had some fertility problems, we went to a doctor, we had some problems having a baby, we went to a doctor, it's all sorted. You know, oh, we have twins now, which often happens, right? You don't even talk about it. When it first happened, it was test tube babies, is what it was called, and people freaked out. There were books written about test tube babies.
Babies made in a bottle.
Yes, and it was like, we've ventured Brave New World, we're going to have the alphas to the deltas and so on. And now it's like, whatever. And actually in Scandinavia, in countries, IVF is actually pretty expensive. In countries where the healthcare system subsidizes it or just pays for it, it's up to 4%, 1 in 25 babies born is conceived. Because actually like a fairly large number of couples are naturally infertile for some reason. So, and now, like, GMOs, genetically modified foods, I think fit in the same thing. We haven't yet really gotten to the point of being able to genetically enhance yourself, genetically enhance your children, or not even enhance, like, can you, you know, snip out the genetic propensity for breast cancer in your unborn daughter, or snip out, you know, something that's going to increase the risk of Alzheimer's later on, or give them a slightly better chance of a higher IQ. That sort of thing is out there. You know, maybe a decade away or something like that. And that will bring up all kinds of huge debates as well. And there is a very kind of innate squeamishness about biological technologies. But usually, eventually, we get over it.
Yeah. And we have another part of our genre that'll go a long way to perpetuating concerns around that. I was thinking, we were talking about the genetically modified food. I was back to Paulo again.
I love Paulo. So actually, what I said, Paulo and I chat on Twitter. What I really meant is we spend half the day sometimes arguing about genetically modified foods in a loving way. But Paulo and I actually were on a panel together. He, I, David Brand, Nancy Kras, I was moderating a panel about biotech and fiction. And it was awesome. I actually had to drag him onto the panel because I wanted the audience to get a full spectrum of beliefs. And it is legitimate, because I think that sometimes bringing up the concerns helps us manage it better. Like, Paulo's main concern is I think he's pretty convinced that the science of genetically modified foods can be okay, we can make them safely. He's more concerned that the companies that own them are going to lie about the science and are going to rush through some that are not safe.
Yeah.
Right?
In order to feed shareholder wallet, right?
Feed shareholders instead of the people, right?
Yeah.
So he's like, who is actually making sure? Do you actually trust the regulators enough to make sure that the ones that are coming out are the ones that are safe and not the ones that are unsafe? And I think that's a legitimate concern.
That's a fair point. Yeah, that's a very fair point. Well, let's continue to talk about this intersection of technology and social structure, since we've moved there from the biological component of it. On a macro scale, what are some of the biggest challenges you think and see to social structures that we'll face with this notion of intersection of innovation and society? And I know, as an example, you've been watching the PRISM and NSA discussion and talking about that pretty intensely over the last couple months.
Yeah, so surveillance is one that's really been on my mind. For anybody who has not been keeping abreast of what's been going on, a while ago, a fellow named Edward Snowden, who was a contractor for the NSA, walked out of his office in Hawaii for Booz Allen with a thumb drive full of NSA documents and has started leaking them bit by bit, pretty selectively, and they've shown that the NSA has been lying pretty extensively about what they do and has actually surveilled Americans much more than they do. Now, I will say, we haven't really seen evidence that the NSA has done much that is super duper malicious. We've seen some questionable things. There's a thing called Love Int, where some NSA analysts have been spying on their exes. So don't date anyone who works at the NSA, I would say. But here's the problem. Okay? It wasn't that long ago we had J. Edgar Hoover was the head of the FBI. There's some things people don't even recognize about how terrible J. Edgar Hoover was. So at the height of the civil rights movement, J. Edgar Hoover was bugging Dr. Martin Luther King's home and hotel rooms. And when he was doing this, then the FBI agents had to stealthily break into Martin Luther King's home to place the bugs. They had to, like, get into the hotel room without the hotel employees knowing and plant the bugs before Martin Luther King could get there. So that actually made it a little bit harder on them and put some constraints. And what Hoover did with this was actually pretty terrible. He found evidence that Martin Luther King had at least one affair, which, you know, tarnishes his image. But what Hoover did with this was he wanted to destroy MLK. He didn't want the civil rights movement to succeed. J. Edgar Hoover started sending threatening letters anonymously to Martin Luther King saying, I know your dirty secrets. You have to, like, stop what you're doing. Basically saying, you have to, like, stop the civil rights movement or I'm going to destroy you publicly. So that was what he was doing. I mean, there's other things that we know that he was doing. So the NSA has, so far as we know, has not done anything like that. Okay, but that is the kind of abuse that's possible when you have a too powerful surveillance state. And here's where we get into technological change. In those days, you had to physically send FBI agents or whoever in Watergate, you know, basically hired thieves and people who worked in the White House to break into an office and plant something, and you had kind of more chance of getting caught, and you were limited in your scale. You could only bug one person at once.
Sure.
It's not that case anymore. Now it's like, oh, let's do this little database search. Oh, here's all of Verizon's phone records, and here's all the Google searches, and here's all the Gmails, and all the Outlook mails, and yada, yada, yada. We estimate the NSA traps at least 75% of all communications traffic inside the United States. So if somebody wanted to, and some unethical person was in charge and could find a way around the limits that are in place, the possible abuses are much, much, much worse because technology has allowed the surveillance state to scale much, much higher.
And you're not talking just the potential for abuse. So the potential grows exponentially.
Yes.
But the depth.
And the depth, absolutely.
So the depth of the abuse.
It's because it's everything. It's like, you know, because they have...
It's not just a few microphone recordings of Martin Luther King, you know, talking to a strange woman. We're talking about a lot more data, texts. And
they can turn on the microphone on your cell phone remotely. They can turn on the... And this is, I mean, this sounds like conspiracy theory nut stuff, right? But they can turn on the webcam on your laptop remotely, in many cases. They have to install malware to do this, but we've seen that they have written malware and deployed it to millions of computers to do this sort of thing. And I don't think they do this. I don't think the NSA spies on me. I don't think they have much reason to. But it's the kind of thing that we want to head off a problem. We want to make sure that there's appropriate constraints. And we want a robust intelligence community. We want to be aware of future threats. We want to be understanding what's happening in the world. Spying is actually a necessary thing.
Sure.
So I don't want to dismantle the NSA or anything like that, but technology is making it possible closer and closer to Big Brother. And so we have to make sure we have the right checks and balances in place, essentially.
That makes sense. They might spy on you. You've reached a point now with your idealism here, that they might just decide, if you grow too much more of an audience, they might just decide to spy on you.
I actually say that I don't think they spy on me to just not sound paranoid, but a good buddy of mine actually is the only named American who works for WikiLeaks, and he's under a grand jury investigation, and he's, like, come to my house, and we text back and forth and so on. So I'm probably on some list somewhere.
You are on a list.
So I'm at least one hop away. Anyway.
Well, let's talk about...
And that means you're now two hops away, Brent.
So. I am two. Oh,
and all you listeners, sorry about that. Should have gave you a spoiler warning ahead of time.
Yeah, because now if you're listening to this, you're three hops away. So don't identify yourself as a listener of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, right? Yeah. That would be the wise
just
move.
Just kidding. I don't think you're in any more danger than you were.
We've broken a wall here, I think, when we were talking directly to the audience.
Yes.
So let's talk about that, though, as I'm teasing you about the effect writers could have and, you know, you having surveillance put against you. But what effect do you think story has, particularly genre fiction, on our ability to adapt or evolve to a world with more and different applications of technology?
I think it's tremendous. I think it's absolutely huge. And I was just talking and I was just kind of complaining about the trends in the NSA, but David Brin, it talks about this concept of the self-defeating prophecy. Because everybody knows about the self-fulfilling prophecy. That's a normal concept for us. The self-defeating prophecy is the usually dystopian book that is so scary that it creates this idea in society that's like, whoa, we can't let that happen. And it may not fully defeat itself, but it at least creates a warning. So I'd say 1984 is one of those, even though I'm just talking about, hey, the surveillance state and so on. But the reality is everybody has this idea of, oh, 1984, Big Brother, and so therefore we can't allow that to happen. And so the only reason that Americans are somewhat up in arms over this NSA thing, and actually a reasonable number of Americans, the majority of Americans now say they're concerned, at least, is in part because we have this thread of we should worry about government surveillance that exists in part because of books like 1984 and Fahrenheit 451 and so on, which most of us have never read. But the ideas, the memes themselves have gotten out there and perpetuated. And honestly, you know, friends in other countries, I know a lot of Russians who live in Seattle for some reason, and they're like, they're glad that I'm up in arms about this, but they also kind of just shake their heads because they look at what's happening in Russia and this is wouldn't even, you know, move the needle in terms of what surveillance is like in Russia, at least with their perception of it, in any case. And that tradition kind of isn't there. So that's, I think that's absolutely correct. Brave New World certainly impacted perceptions of biotechnology, even though it was written before biotechnology as such really existed. I think Apollo's wind-up girl affects, you know, perceptions of things like genetically modified foods. And it's an anti-corporatist book, or it's a book warning about the dangers of unchecked corporate power. So I think all of those things are important. On the flip side, I would say that X-Men is a story, it's a civil rights story about discrimination. But it's really saying people that are genetically different should not be discriminated against either. And if society gets to a point where we have children that have been genetically manipulated in some way, I think X-Men will have actually served a vital... I mean, they probably won't have blue skin or the ability to teleport. Yes. But, you know, but I think X-Men will have actually served a vital purpose at that point of having established this storyline, this narrative in society of, hey, you shouldn't discriminate against someone just because they're genetically different from you and I.
I'm glad you brought up X-Men and the notion of the flip side of not just the self-defeating, but the optimistic story. And you said you're an optimist by trait. And you made me recall, as you were talking about that, a conversation I had with Nancy Kress a couple of years ago, where she didn't think in today's environment it would be viable to actually write an optimistic science fiction story.
Well, and you know, Nancy was saying that on our panel. It's funny, like, some people categorize Nexus as a dystopia. I don't. Nexus is not a dystopia. Nexus is actually a very optimistic story. Mm-hmm. I would say also Ian Banks, you know, so sad to lose him. Ian Banks wrote, if you haven't read Ian Banks, folks, you really should. Ian Banks wrote Space Opera. He wrote Space Opera where horrible, terrible things happen in a utopia. And I don't mean that in a cynical way. He wrote about an incredibly optimistic future, but then he realized you can't have 500 pages of, and then another wonderful day passed where they played games and watched the sunset and the minds thought their deep thoughts and so on. So he puts all of his stories at the edges of that society where conflict is happening to make the world even better. Right?
Sure.
And that's kind of how I view Nexus. The world really is a better place, but there is conflict, there is struggle going on to push forward things even more. And I think of X-Men as like that too. X-Men actually has a lot of very dark themes. The X-Men are often fighting against discrimination or fighting against the even more radical folks. Like Magneto is somebody who has been persecuted by discrimination and is striking back. That's He's become true. An extremist. Mm-hmm. And I actually think Nexus is a story very much along the lines of X-Men, actually, where Kade, the protagonist, is kind of, he's in the middle. The government forces are, for reasons for good reasons. They're scared of this technology. They want to clamp down on it. And there are some people more extreme than Cade who are like, oh no, this will not do, and the government has to come down. We have to, like, post-humans have to come into existence, and we will not stand for anyone stopping us. And I think that's kind of how society splinters.
Sure.
And I'm actually usually on the side of people in the middle saying, okay, let's be a little reasonable. Like, we want to make progress, and just because somebody is being stupid about things doesn't mean they have to be your sworn enemy. It's better to win them over than to fight them.
Yeah, let's understand what the challenges are and then work through the challenges. As about, like you said, with Paulo, it's let's have a conversation and bring those challenges to light. And then we can have an intelligent conversation about those challenges and figure out how to navigate around them.
Yeah.
or mitigate them. So that's very fair. So as we're having this conversation around technology, how do you master or use technology in the craft of writing? We have a lot of folks that listen to the show that are actually aspiring writers. And how do you use that in your daily life, maybe to, I'm going back from macro to micro here. Yeah. How do you use that on your daily life?
Well, I do two things. So everybody says, hey, the number one thing you got to do when you're writing a book is just write. Like, write every day, get your stuff done. So at a micro level, one thing I do is I turn off the internet when I'm writing, if I have to. There are some days that I don't have to, that I'm just enough in the flow, I just get stuff done. But I use a program called Freedom. It's MacFreedom.com, but it's available for the Mac and the PC. And it's the simplest program in the world. You run it, and you tell it, how long do you want the internet off for on your laptop? And, you know, 45 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, and the internet's off on the laptop or just on that device. If you want to turn the internet back on, you reboot, and the internet comes back on earlier than you wanted. Otherwise, when the time's up, it just says, congrats, you're done, you're back online. And that is the simplest thing, but it's one of these distraction addiction things.
Sure.
That it just helps you break free of the temptation of going and, like, alt-tabbing over, like, switching over to that other window and be like, are there any new tweets? You know, is there going to be, like, a new thing on my Facebook page? Has this feed updated? Maybe it's just in that email.
Well, and if you're a Mac user, too, they built the OS to the point, the integration with all the social features, they would be hammering you otherwise.
Yeah, that's the same for me, actually. I use TweetDeck, and, the new tweets are, like, appearing.
Showing up in the upper right or wherever you've chosen them in your preferences.
So yeah, exactly. So that's one thing. The other thing I do, not all writers are like this, I'm an outliner. I sit and I work through the outline of my story in as much detail as I can, and then I put the outline down in Excel for me, but you can use whatever you want, and my outline is pretty detailed. It says, you know, what scene is this, you know, what's the name of the scene, what's the point of view character, you know, a bunch of bullet points about the text, what's going to happen in the scene. And then vitally, and you, how many words is it going to be? But then vitally for me, what day am I going to write this scene on? And that's my schedule. So when I, it might take me a month or maybe even 6 weeks or 2 months to outline a novel. But at the end of that, I have a schedule that tells me, here are the days I'm going to get certain things done. And now I have a boss, kind of. And I have a schedule to stick to. And honestly, I've never hit that schedule exactly. But I might, you know, be a week late or 2 weeks late or something. But I have something that is telling me, today this is what I have to get done. And that's actually more effective for me than knowing, oh, I have to write 1,000 words today or 2,000 words or 3,000 words. Or, oh, I have to write for 2 hours or 3 hours, whatever. Those are interesting, but those are kind of measures of something other than final product. Because final product is not number of words written, it's this chunk of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that chunk of the story actually took you more words than you expected. That's my problem.
Sure.
Or it took you less. And certainly hours written, that can just be staring at the keyboard. So that's how I like to do it. That also forces me to think it through. Like, some of my favorite stories are the ones that are super tight in the sense of things happen at the beginning that don't fully become clear what they meant until the very end. And that requires thinking through the novel. It also, I find, I actually don't think that well when I'm typing. This is a funny thing to say. I can separate kind of story creation from dialogue writing and so on. So I can spend a lot of time brainstorming, and that brainstorming might happen on a bike ride or in the shower, or it'll happen like typing in outline mode in Word or whatever, and like get the whole thing kind of in my head as one big story, and then I can start typing in the digital pieces. And of course the outline changes as you go a little bit, but at least it gives you some baseline schedule to stick to.
You hold the story maybe in your head and you have a framework, a good framework for it, and then you can actually layer it. You can get it layered down.
Yeah, exactly.
And then evolve it from there.
Exactly.
Well, you were talking about having a boss now and some deadlines. So folks that have read the book, well, you've got Crux coming out here soon. What are you working on now?
I'm working on the third and final Nexus novel. It's called Apex, and it will come out in fall of 2014.
Excellent. Excellent. We'll look forward to it. So, and we won't preview it too much because Crux, let's talk about Crux for just a second then. What do we have Caden up to tier two? And Mike Underwood, I spoke with him Thursday evening when I got in, and he said, as much as you love Nexus, he said the pacing of Crux is like amped up, hyper adrenaline amped up beyond what you saw in Nexus. So what are we putting Caden through in this one?
Crux starts pretty explosively and keeps it up. I'm in the David Brand also school of you can't let the reader put the book down if you can avoid it. Crux picks up a few months after the end of Nexus, and some things have happened and the world has changed a little bit. It's got a few more storylines going on. You see the world through a few sets of eyes, through Cade's eyes, through Sam's eyes, and a couple others. And you're dealing with the consequences of the things that have happened in Nexus. And it's sort of the Empire Strikes Back of the three books. Ooh. It's a little darker. Some bad things happen. Some beautiful things and some great scenes and some like fantastic uplifting things. There's a little bit more humor in it as well.
Okay.
Fang, if any of you have read Nexus, a lot of people enjoyed Fang. And yeah. Fang gets a bigger role in this. And he's a funny guy. People seem to like him. And you see a lot more of Su-Yong-Shu, actually. And there's some pretty explosive and devastating things that happen, and it ends on a pretty powerful note, I think. And people who finish it are like, ah, give me book three.
And we have to wait till when? Till 2014?
Fall of 2014. About a year, a little more than a year from now.
You're freaking killing me.
Sorry, but you know, I was about to name a name, but it will not be 5 years until the next book, let's just say. I've got a deadline, the first draft.
You got a boss, he is a boss, folks.
Yes, I have a deadline, and I'm not famous enough to miss my deadlines. So,
awesome.
You will have the book next year.
Awesome. Well, this has been excellent. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Rameznaam.com, RamezNaam.com. Or you can follow me on Twitter at Ramez, RamEz.
Awesome. Ramez or Mez,
yes,
as people around Mez here like to call you. Anything else you'd like to mention to our listeners that I may have missed?
This has just been awesome, Brent. Thanks.
Mez, I really appreciate you taking the time.
This has been great, man.
And yeah. I look forward to reading Crux in the next book.
Fantastic. Thanks.
Visit Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing for show notes, links, reviews, special guests, videos, and more. Email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at musically.com. No authors were seriously damaged in the making of this podcast.